the Grow Young Project. My name's Rod Francis. And today we're going to be speaking to Arlene Weintraub. And if you haven't heard of her already, Arlene is a leading writer and author working from the USA with many years of experience writing about healthcare and science, pharmaceuticals and biotechnology. And I came across Arlene when I read her first book, which was called Selling the Fountain of Youth. And if you haven't already read it, it's highly recommended. It's the most extraordinary expose of the anti-aging industry. So no point me talking about it anymore. Why don't we go and have a listen to what happened in the interview and stick around. It is fascinating. So firstly, I noticed that when you were inspired to write Selling of the Fountain of Youth, which was the result of a Business Week article in 2005, I'd really love to know a little bit more about your inspiration and your motivation at the times, and also perhaps some of your concerns.
Okay, well, what happened was, back in the mid-2000s, I was working on staff as a science writer at Business Week magazine, and I covered the biotechnology field. And one of the sort of flagship biotechnology drugs was human growth hormone. And I knew all about this drug from having covered the industry, and I started to hear from people that that they were finding out about human growth hormone being prescribed to perfectly healthy adults. And we on the science staff were somewhat captivated by this, because human growth hormone was originally approved to treat children with growth problems and a small amount of adults, but adults with the serious pituitary issues and so forth. And it was just very interesting that this was being embraced as a new fountain of youth. And then as I got into it more and more, I discovered a whole bunch of other hormones that that this group of doctors that had just popped up calling themselves anti-aging doctors were prescribing, particularly to women, as the sort of alternative to growing old. And the alternative to sort of the big pharma remedies for things like menopausal hot flashes. And so I just got more and more into it. I went through an anti-aging assessment myself, and I slowly began to realize that I thought people were being scammed, and possibly in a way that could be dangerous to their health. So that's how the book came about.
Right. Yeah. Great. Really picked up when you're sort of talking, even mentioning yourself, you know, the usage of big pharma, and it's a really common image, I find, that people, or some in the communities, will see big pharma, and they'll also put government all in this same cahoots against the common man scenario. And it seems as though the anti-aging industry paints itself as a kind of little homespun business that's up against these big guys, a kind of David and Goliath. Is that your opinion?
Yes, that's exactly what they do, and they do a very good job of persuading patients that big pharma and traditional medicine are the bad guys, but we, these anti-aging doctors, are going to sit down, we're going to spend an hour with you getting to know you, we're going to tailor all these medications to what your specific needs are, and you will never grow old. And what they don't tell patients is that they're running a business also, and they're making millions of dollars also. And you know, I think patients get very taken in, because these are doctors that are selling them these products, and everybody tends to trust doctors, and it's really dangerous, I think.
Yes, something I really got from the way you presented this, and even my own research seems to show this, is, of course, a lot of doctors, they truly believe in what they're doing, but it might be fair to say that they're not really getting a fully balanced view on the science behind all of the medicine. Would that be fair to say?
Right, that's true. They do really believe in what they're doing, and they really believe that they're helping patients. And what I found kind of striking was that a lot of anti-aging doctors actually do these remedies themselves. They take these hormones and they follow their own advice, and of course that makes it even more alluring to patients, because after all, if my doctor is doing it, it must be safe.
Yeah, absolutely. And
I can think of a very famous anti-aging doctor whose posters I've seen in gyms across the world, to be honest. And it does look very alluring when you're 65 and you want to have a body like Jason Bourne. Secondly, in this dance around regulations and the big pharma story, something I found really interesting in your presentation of that is that it's a much more balanced view, because you seem to lay out a very clear a dialogue that's going on between what is really a big industry in the anti-aging industry and often the hands that are tied in the pharmaceutical industry. But to me, more importantly, with the FDA, that it seems to me that their hands are really very tied, and yet they seem to be have the finger pointed at them as being the bad guys often. What's your opinion on that?
Right. Well, in my book, I write extensively about compounding pharmacies, yeah, which are these mom-and-pop pharmacies, for the most part, that tailor some of these drugs. In other words, the doctor will prescribe estrogen and progesterone in a certain mix for a certain woman, and then they send it to the compounding pharmacist, and that compounding pharmacist actually puts the ingredients together and makes this hormone-based remedy. Well, that's all perfectly legal, but what happened when anti-aging started to take off was that some of these pharmacies began mass marketing these concoctions of hormones that are not FDA approved. And the FDA was sort of in a bind, because there's all these conflicting Supreme Court rulings and lower court rulings that make it very difficult to determine what exactly is legal for a compounding pharmacy to do. So what has ended up happening is that these pharmacies don't have very much oversight at all, and yet they're manufacturing drugs for the most part, but they don't have to comply with the same FDA regulations that a big pharma company does, and so nobody really knows if those products are safe and if they actually have in them what they say they have in them. And actually, it's interesting, since the book came out, there's been a huge uproar over this issue, because there have been some serious safety issues with compounding pharmacies. And in fact, I've been putting on Twitter over the past couple of weeks that suddenly it looks like the FDA is really cracking down on some of these pharmacies. So there was some legislation passed that gave the FDA a bit more leeway, and now it looks like it's going to be a bit more difficult for compounding pharmacies to do business the way they used to.
Okay, yes, I was going to ask you about that, because I was aware that last year the Obama administration signed in a law, but it would seem to be voluntary.
It's sort of it's a stopgap measure. It's not perfect. It's not complete oversight, but it's better than what they had before. That was my assessment of it at the time. There's still quite a bit of leeway for compounding pharmacies. So we'll see what happens. It's been interesting. They have been recalling over the past couple of weeks some anti-aging products made by compounding pharmacies. Mm-hmm. So I'm watching it with a lot of interest, for sure.
That was going to be one of my questions to you as well, is, how has it been? Because it's been now probably close to, 3.5 years since the book was published. And so do you still maintain an active interest in this industry?
Oh, I'm definitely interested in it on a lot of levels. Number one is this legislative level that we've been talking about. I thought it was rather tragic that people had to die in order for this legislation to get passed. That's essentially what happened. Was a compounding pharmacy had made a meningitis treatment that wasn't safe. And, I hope that that we don't see more of that, and particularly in the anti-aging industry, where it's often healthy people that are going in and that are taking these hormones in order to become better. I continue to watch it from the legislative side, but also I'm just constantly fascinated by the lengths that people will go to try to stay young. And I say in my book, the only thing that's really proven scientifically to work is exercise. Mm-hmm. And yet everybody is still looking for that magic pill or the, you know, Chinese herb or, mm-hmm. or something that's just so much easier to do than exercise, yet none of that's mm-hmm. been proven. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you just go out and walk for a half hour a day, you can do incredible things for your longevity.
Yeah. I'm fascinated with this area myself, as well, how much resistance humans seem to have to doing these small amounts of interventions, which are basically costless.
Right.
And you know, I can't help but see a sort of similarity in the way that how a lot of us have come to see the medical profession generally, that, you know, we take our illness to them and hand it over, in a sense, and ask this person just to deal with it rather than having any involvement ourselves in the process.
Right. And, you know, one thing that I do give the anti-aging industry credit for is that many of these doctors incorporate exercise counseling and nutritional counseling into mm-hmm. their practices. But, of course, there's very little they can do to make patients do it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just so much easier to give them the magic injection mm-hmm. or hormone or mm-hmm. or pill than it is to make them exercise.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a problem not only with this industry, but with the medical industry more broadly. It's very hard to intervene in lifestyle choices.
Absolutely. And there seemed to be some movement in the U.S. insurance industry where they were realizing that if they took the burden for the tsunami of obesity and all these diseases that are basically caused by lifestyle, that they needed to find some way of getting the public to intervene themselves and take some responsibility. But that's a difficult ask.
Right, and I have seen some interesting projects pop up sponsored by the insurance industry. For example, mm-hmm. there was one company, can't remember which one, but I think that they were doing an experiment where they were taking obese children and giving them access to these video games like Dance Dance Revolution, where you really have to move.
Mm-hmm.
And they were going to track what kind of weight loss happened over time. And, you know, they were providing the video game systems to mm-hmm. the children. And I applaud that. I think that the industry does need to get more involved in promoting healthy lifestyles because, you know, I mean, obviously it helps them. It helps them their bottom lines. But it keeps people healthier helps them financially. But it's also better for society in general, I think.
Yeah. This is something that one kind of imagines might be something that come from top down in terms of governmental intervention, but then that's often seen as really unwelcome. And I'm certainly from my US colleagues that it always seems that people are very unwilling in the US to have government intervention in these areas. Would that be the case?
Well, yes and no. I think one of the things that the government has done recently has given incentives to hospitals and other healthcare providers for favorable outcomes. And these are financial incentives for keeping people out of the hospital, for example. And the way that they've responded has been really interesting. For example, a number of hospitals in the States have open their own exercise facilities, and they staff these facilities with exercise physiologists and people with real medical training. And you don't have to be a patient to use it. Anybody in the community can go in and use these facilities. But of course, they really push people like people who have shown up in the emergency room with heart attacks are really encouraged to keep coming back to the hospital, but to go to these facilities and to exercise and to work with a trainer and really get on a routine that's going to keep them from coming back to the hospital in the future. So that seems to me to benefit everybody involved, the patient as well as the hospital, and it is being encouraged by the government.
Listen, just to return to the subject of hormones, actually, which I'm really interested in. Since you published Selling the Fountain of Youth, has anything else happened in the world of HGH or other hormones and supplements, or is it still just business as usual for the anti-aging industry?
I get the impression that they are still recruiting a lot of patients, particularly women, and my biggest concern is these bioidentical hormones, as they call them, which are primarily estrogen and progesterone, and they continue to persuade women going through menopause that the solutions offered by Big Pharma are dangerous and they can cause cancer, and these so-called bioidentical hormones that you get at your compounding pharmacy won't do any of that. And of course, none of that is true, but they continue to be very effective at selling that message. And one thing that has happened since the book has come out is that this is starting to happen on the male side now as well with testosterone products. And there's now a very fresh controversy that has erupted over whether men need to replace their testosterone as they age. And this has become a multi-billion dollar industry. Interestingly, this part of the industry is driven by Big Pharma, not by compounding pharmacies. So there's legitimate products on the market that were originally approved for men with serious testosterone deficiencies that are now being sold to basically any guy who feels that he's not top of his game. It's become a very popular this idea of low T, low testosterone, has become a very popular diagnosis, even though there's very little science to back it up.
Are you aware of health downsides related to that? Anything that you particularly heard of?
Well, the FDA has started an investigation into some reports of testosterone supplementation possibly being linked to an increased cardiovascular risk, and everybody's sort of waiting on the edge of their seat to see what the FDA does. There's already a lot of warnings on the products, but there's a feeling that they could crack down and really require possibly post-marketing studies or more warnings, even harsher warnings on the labels. But these drugs are really, they're very heavily advertised in the U.S., and that's driven a lot of the interest in this idea that, oh, I'm getting older, I must have low T. I'm just going to take this drug and I'll be fine.
Actually, I have a few buddies asking me these questions, to be honest, because this is my area. But, you know, I find this fascinating too, because it, what I read is that there's this sort of pathologizing of perfectly normal developmental changes that we all have. And it just seems to be yet another marketing tool. And I've often heard this criticism even put towards areas such as the DSM, you know, that we pathologize a mental condition and we can sell a pill for it. So that really seems to be behind this to me, that there's a kind of pathologizing of things that are perfectly normal changes, would you say?
Right, and in fact, there's a whole school of thought that says, yes, our hormones decline as we age, but perhaps there's a reason for that, an evolutionary reason. Perhaps it's actually protective that our hormones decline as we age. And, you know, it's a compelling argument, I think, because some hormones have been linked to an increased risk of cancer. So perhaps our body is doing something to protect us. And it's tough science. It's very hard to study because you're talking about aging and you would have to design these 25 year studies and really really try to figure out what's going on, and it's just very difficult. It's possible it may never be done, and so the questions will never be answered. And meanwhile, everybody's going out and doing these risky drugs on the chance that it might keep them young.
It is a very risky kind of lifestyle experiment, really, isn't it? And I hear a lot of very credible scientists like Olshansky and Carnes and Hayflick really putting out the call for funding in order to explore this prospect of aging, but it is expensive, as you said, doing these kind of studies, and they're long term.
Right.
Yeah. I'm just wondering, and what else you might have learned since the publication that you would say now definitely include in the book, or that might have even altered your opinion since then?
Well, I haven't heard anything that would alter my opinion. Mm-hmm. If anything, these things that have happened that we've talked about, I think have really verified what I said in the book. Mm. What I continue to be fascinated by is what does work. And like I said, there's lots of studies coming out on the benefits of exercise. And I wish that more would be written about that, and also more would be written about it in a practical way, so that people who feel that they just can't make time for this, or people who may be very obese and feel that they don't have the energy to exercise, are given practical tips to get started on an exercise regimen that they can incorporate into their lives. Mm. I think that kind of material needs to get more attention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's wonderful, actually. To be honest, actually, that was pretty well the inspiration for starting the Grow Young Project for me. Because that's the thing I love doing is inspiring people. I work with people mostly as a coach. In my other life, and that's really the business is how do we find the intrinsic motivation to make that change? Yeah, and that is the million-dollar question, that's for sure. One other question I'd like to ask was, you know, for you, what was the take-home message from doing all this project for you? You may have already answered it in saying exercise is the thing, but is there anything else you would add to that?
I think the take-home message for me is to ask questions, and I have been asked, particularly by women, what I would recommend that they do. If they are getting a pitch from an anti-aging doctor and they feel like they want to try these hormones, and I always tell them, go and get a second opinion from somebody who doesn't call themselves an anti-aging doctor, and listen to what they have to say, because there is no magic pill. It's unfortunate, but it's true. There's no magic pill, and if you're being sold one, you need to really be skeptical and get lots of opinions and do your homework.
But I notice you're doing a project with cancer and dogs, and I'm really intrigued with that. Would you like to? I'd love to hear just a little bit about that.
Oh, well, thank you for asking. That's actually going to be my second book, and the title is Heal: The Vital Role of Dogs in the Search for Cancer Cures. Mm. And it's about the expanding role of a field of research called comparative oncology. And the idea of this is to recruit dogs that develop cancer naturally and go to their veterinarians, to recruit them for studies that may end up helping both dogs and people with cancer. And what a lot of people don't know is that dogs get some of the same cancers that people do. And as it turns out, there have been some pretty exciting discoveries made in veterinary clinics that have ended up helping people. And so that's a short explanation of my book. And I often tell people that this book is about good doctors doing good things, whereas the first book was about bad doctors doing bad things.
But that, it sounds really, really fascinating. And of course, I think we can't have a conversation about aging without having a conversation about cancer, because one of the top causes of mortality as we age is going to be cancer. So I think it's important to have these conversations together in a sense. So, and when are you planning on publication for the book?
That should be out in the fall of 2015.
Well, thank you very much, and I'm going to call the interview to a close.